Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Good day and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Father Matt Malone, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine.
And I'm Carrie Weber, Executive Editor for America. And each week we offer you the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world gathered by our team at America Media.
And we are joined here in the studio by the central nervous system of that team. Tim Reedy, our executive editor.
Good to see you all again. I don't think we've been on the show together in a while.
Yeah,
I know.
Nice.
And we inaugurated this podcast,
I know.
Didn't we? Yeah, the three of
the
us.
The band's back together.
The reunion tour. And it's worth noting that if you go to our website, americamagazine.org/SiriusXM, there's a really good interview that our colleague Kevin Clark did with a Korean bishop. It's called As Winter Olympics Draw Near, South Korean Bishop Maintains Hope for Peace with North Korea. And I think it's worth a look. It goes deeper into some of the topics that we were discussing before the break. And it is hopeful at a time when not a lot of people are feeling hopeful about this issue.
Yeah, no, he does. I mean, some interesting quotes, very critical of some of the statements that the president has made about North Korea, but also trying to, he reminds us that, as many problems we may have with the North Korean regime, remember that these people, are very poor, and we must always remember that. And also that they're also very proud of their heritage. So, you have to engage that and kind of understand that when you speak about them and when you try to engage them. So, and the South Koreans, of course, are, very much on the front lines of this.
Yeah, and he talks about this in the context of hoping that President Trump applies these lessons to his language, right? To use a more refined sense of language and understanding this honor and this pride and not just trying to, belittle people with nicknames and broad statements.
Absolutely.
I agree with the bishop. That would be a nice thing. I'm not sure that's realistic. The president is who he is, and I do think it's really important. While we may not quite ever understand exactly what drives him, it's really important that we understand what our fellow citizens. Who voted for him, who have supported him, about what it is that's driving them and their concerns, and to that end, we had a great piece in the magazine by John Miller.
Yeah, it's called West Virginia Town Looks for a New Start in Trump's America, and you can find it at americamagazine.org/SiriusXM. And John Miller is a writer who is based in Pittsburgh, used to work for the Wall Street Journal, grew up in Brussels, and has reported from 27 different countries. So this trip through West Virginia was maybe less exotic, but maybe more lessons in a sense. It sometimes... our own country can feel foreign to us at times.
Yeah, you can be surprised by what's happening in your own backyard.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. He's got several awards for his reporting, and we're glad to have him in our pages. John Miller, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So what prompted you, John, to travel out to West Virginia and to do this reporting?
Well, I'm going to start off by saying that I grew up in Brussels, and even though I sound very American and my parents are American, being in the U.S. is often like being in a foreign country. So I still have that line about being a foreign correspondent that you can only write about a place if you've been there less than 10 days or more than 10 years. And I'm still surprised by things I see. So my connection to Moundsville started a few years ago. I was driving back from something, I forget what, maybe like to see a coal mine, because I covered the coal industry for the Wall Street Journal, and I saw a sign, driving through Moundsville, I saw a sign that said, Paranormal Hot Dog Stand.
Wow.
I stopped off and met a guy named Steve Hummel who had opened a hot dog stand, and it hadn't really worked out, so he had put a bunch of like spooky antiques in there and called it paranormal and attracted visitors and was sort of moonlighting as a sort of tourist thing. And
it worked. You pulled over, right?
Yeah. I pulled over and stopped and wrote a story about Steve for Halloween for the front page of the journal.
This
and
did
I
not make it into our story.
No, I don't like to repeat that. I thought it'd be great to go back to Moundsville. And then in the context of the Trump moment and looking at their numbers and how much they supported Trump, and learning more about the town, I thought this would be a great kind of stand-in for what's happening all over the Midwest.
Right. And so this is Moundsville, West Virginia, which is in Marshall County, which Mr. Trump carried 73% to 22%, right?
Correct, yeah.
And so, you know, tell us about the folks there and you know, why, you know, what they're concerned about, what they're worried about, and you know, whether, you know, the Trump administration is delivering on the promise they saw in him.
Like all Trump vote, or like most Trump supporters, voted for him because he's a businessman, and they thought that economic prosperity might follow in the form of factory jobs, or at least the companies that are there hiring more. And the truth is that there aren't a great rush of companies building new factories in towns like this because the labor force is not there, the markets aren't really there. It's not really realistic. And so they're sobering up a little bit. But what they're looking at is an economy that actually does work. It just works differently than it might have worked 30 or 40 years ago when they did have thousands of factory jobs. And one thing that's amazing about Moundsville, it still blows my mind, is they used to make everything there. I mean, there was a factory in the 30s that made airplanes. And this is not just like some small Appalachian town that only had a coal mine. This is like, you know, like one of those economic zones in China. Like, they made belts and shoes and clothes and toys. And now the only factory left is a bottle cap factory. But to get back to your question, I mean, they're concerned with coping with the economy they do have as opposed to trying to recover a fantasy economy that's not going to come back. And that's an economy based on energy, so gas and coal, which they have, both of which they have, and services, so things like the big Walmart, or there's a casino nearby too in Wheeling, or tourism. They have two big tourist attractions, and they're also focused on bringing in more tourists.
Now, the picture you paint is not one that sort of is in line with the picture that President Trump used in his inauguration speech about, quote, American carnage, you point out, right? It's not, although it seems to be one of the types of towns that he's sort of alluding to, but the reality in the town actually has a lot more vibrancy to it despite its economic struggles, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's not hell with people lying in the streets dying of opium or opioid addictions. It's not a place that is kind of obviously prospering with a bright future no matter what. I mean, if energy prices crash, it could also crash. I think its main problem is it's getting older and its community ties are fraying in ways that are becoming more and more obvious. And I think a lot of the studies have shown that the divisiveness in the country right now is due in part to community groups, be it church groups or bowling leagues or local historical associations reporting fewer and fewer members, so people get together less often. Technology allows people not to go out and meet each other. In a place that has a graying population like Moundsville, it's especially vulnerable to that because you don't have young people going out and making new things happen.
Yeah, that's a big part of your story, John, that people worry about, is that young people tend to leave because if they want jobs in the tech sector or, you know, in any number of industries, they're more likely to find jobs on the coasts than in places like Moundsville. But that kind of has that can have a real, it can really hurt the community in so many ways.
That's right. And I think it's part of the inequality that is deepening in the country, where you have bright kids in places like Moundsville. It's not hard for them to see that life is better or perceived to be better in the big cities. And it's not hard for them to find opportunity. I mean, tech sectors are growing. White collar jobs, for the most part, are doing just fine in this country. And so they do leave and seek opportunity if they have the skills to leave. And I mean, economically, it's sort of one of the biggest tragedies I've found reporting is that economically, the right thing to do is for them to leave and to leave behind their communities from a strictly rational point of view. And you talk to some economists who say, I mean, that is what they should be doing. And especially if I mean, Moundsville is doing better than a lot of places, but in some of these small towns, the biggest source of income is now transfer payments, so disability and Social Security. And there's really, you know, less and less kind of classic capitalist economic rationale for anybody to stay. And that's a tragedy in a sense that it's hard to see what a sort of happy human outcome is.
Well, and you mentioned this cap factory. They have job openings, but they have problems finding people because many of the young people have left or working in the gas industry.
Yeah, and the thing is that some of these short-term gas jobs are very lucrative and can pay six figures, even if you don't have a college degree. They're not forever, but I mean, gas is doing pretty good right now. Why work for $20 an hour and make, you know, 40 a year when you can make 100 working in the gas fields? Even if your contract runs out after 6 months, it's still a better short-term alternative.
So how are they responding now to, I mean, what you say that there's a greater sobriety and there are talks about Mr. Trump, but it also seems like it was there from the beginning, right? They really were just focused on the fact that they thought this was the candidate who could actually help us the most in rebuilding our economy, and they kind of ignored all the other stuff, right, that took up so much of the airwaves.
That's true, and for some of those economic portfolios, they're not totally off base in saying that the president has helped them, especially in coal, where EPA regulations and health and safety regulations are not being enforced as they were during the Obama years, and coal companies are kind of breathing a little more easily, and you've had increased production this year in West Virginia and elsewhere. You also had increased miner deaths, by the way, in coal mines. I haven't looked carefully at the numbers, so I'm not going to draw any conclusions, but that is a fact. And so there's a mine right outside of Moundsville, and the main character in the story, his son, actually works at that mine, and they've rehired workers they had laid off under Obama, and they're part of this trend that has West Virginia exporting a lot more coal than last year, especially to Asia.
How did you find yourself being received when you were there? Were people eager to kind of talk about these things? Were they worried about your perception of them or being judged or, you know, being quoted on these issues?
A little bit. The younger people more, because I think they felt like they might be kind of more judged for thinking about leaving, basically. Pretty much everybody who's under 40 has left, even if they come back. The older people were pretty excited to talk about the glories of the past. I mean, it is very much a cultural bubble. A lot of the people wanted to meet at the McDonald's, which had a big screen TV playing Fox News all day. And it very much is part of that part of America that watches Fox News and has a kind of different set of political beliefs and realities than most people on the coast.
And now, John, one of the interesting things about your piece is the role in which faith plays in sort of the lives and the decisions of these folks, and the way in which the economic situation and the situation in which young people are leaving affects those faith communities as well. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, it's hard for churches like the Catholic Church in Moundsville, which in the past had a broad base of working class parishioners who were young and had kids and sent their kids to local school and worked in the local factories and were the product of immigration in the 19th century and early 20th century. And now with the young generations leaving, are left with a mostly older population. I went to Mass one morning and it was, I probably was the only person there under 50. I mean, it really is a dramatic graying. And there's only one priest there who's a lovely Vietnamese diocesan priest who I spent some time with. And he struggles to kind of keep the parish energized. He compares the struggles of Appalachia to his native Vietnam. He left right after the war, and he points to how the exploitation of resources and the end of a lot of the coal mining communities has left a lot of the church communities in Appalachia, and especially West Virginia, with not enough resources and members to really operate as a sort of the kind of prosperous parish that a lot of our listeners might have known growing up, and that you think of when you think of a healthy church community. And so he struggles to keep things together, and he sees the church as a way, though, of keeping people hopeful and giving people sort of direction and ideas and some hope in a time that's still tough for a lot of people.
And he's working against, John, as you write about, I mean, several different trends. I mean, he points to technology as one thing that he struggles with in terms of trying to reach out to young people. There's a huge gap between how he and perhaps people who are of the generation who attend daily mass use technology and young people. And he kind of lays some blame on the feet of Steve Jobs here in his piece. But, I mean, you're working against that trend. The fact that, as you point out in other parts of the piece, people just are not as involved in any kind of community activity. So church is part of that. So you also quote here William Portier, who I believe has written for America before, about the challenges of creating a church in a place like this.
Yeah, that's right. Bill Portier, by the way, taught me theology 20 years ago at St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland. He made the point to me that church is about at least two things, one of which is receiving the sacraments, and the other is building community. And when people make it, when it becomes more individualistic, a faith like Catholicism becomes more vulnerable when you start losing the community aspect, when it becomes a matter purely of individual choice. And the main character in the story, Phil Remke, is actually a man who grew up with Catholicism and is now, he attends Catholic Church because his wife is still a staunch Catholic, but he also, after Catholic Church, goes to a evangelical service in Wheeling, where he prefers the bells and whistles and what he calls the more rock and roll aspect of the service.
Right. So it's not just the young people who are sort of interested in alternative forms of worship in a sense, but
I didn't really go deep in that trend, but Phil seemed to emblemize it a little bit, and I think there is a growth. I heard stories about a growth in evangelical faiths around Wheeling and Moundsville. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's a couple, you know, some of the voices in the older generation are saying, you know, the church isn't quite keeping up with the times, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the last Catholic school in Moundsville closed this summer, and there was a lot of kind of painful decision making, and people are upset with the diocese for closing the school. And so there's still a willingness to hang on by a lot of people, but the numbers just aren't there to make compelling cases where it's a no-brainer that you have to do things like keep schools open. But there's still a lot of people who are still loyal to the church in Moundsville and really love their priests, and so they are committed to the church, at least in the medium term, for sure.
Yeah, it's a hard balance to strike, because if, you know, there's, it kind of seems like it's a vicious cycle of, if there, you know, there's no young people there, so it's hard to attract more young people, and then other young people look and say, well, there's nobody here, so I'm going to leave, you know, it makes it really hard to build that community. I mean, do you think if more young people decide to stay, there's a sense of opportunity there for them to create for themselves? Or does it feel like they're, you know, the part of the reason they're gone is because there's not even that opportunity?
So that's the hope for a guy like Phil Remke, who's the vice mayor, who's the main character in my story. He sort of likes to compare himself to this mayor that Pittsburgh had in the 1980s, Richard Caligiuri, who right. sort of started this process that led to Pittsburgh becoming like a high-tech hub that has companies like Amazon and Google, and Uber has its self-driving car center here in Pittsburgh. And so Phil would sort of like to see Moundsville be like a mini Pittsburgh. And it's not a totally crazy thought. I mean, it's not far from Washington and Pittsburgh, and it has relatively affordable land and places you could build, like you could imagine like a big tech campus there. I mean, for now, there's a sort of perverse effect of rents being higher because of the gas industry. Even though a lot of the gas people live in these temporary communities that I wrote about too, these sort of high expensive trailers they park outside of town. It's not a totally crazy idea, but it is a long shot that Moundsville would sort of recreate itself as a mini tech city. I mean, the reality, and this is another thing that I should mention, is that there are plenty of jobs, but these jobs are not like the $25 an hour unionized jobs with benefits that people had 20 years ago. They're jobs like working for $10 an hour at Walmart, and I talk to people who work at Walmart, and they say it's a pretty easy job to get, but that's all you're going to get. And I think one lesson I took away from this is that policymakers should be thinking about the economy, the jobs that are there, as opposed to sort of spinning this fantasy that career unionized labor or jobs are going to come back to places like Moundsville.
Yeah, and there's also a sense that what interested me was that the folks, at least that you talked to, who work at Walmart, were focused on talking about creating the conditions around Walmart that would then, the economic conditions, that would then prompt Walmart to raise its wages, right? And, you know, it used to be an older version of that would be that the workers would unionize and actually ask the company to raise the wages, right?
Yeah.
So what's happening there in that dynamic?
If the labor supply became tight enough, Walmart would have to raise their wages. All the studies I've read suggest that America still has a very transient labor force, and Americans are very willing to move for jobs. And I covered macroeconomics in Europe for 7 years for the Wall Street Journal based in Brussels, and that was a big thing, that Europeans do not move to get jobs. I mean, partly it's a social safety
right.
net in Europe, but the fact that Americans will move means that companies like Walmart don't have trouble finding people who will work for $10 an hour. And the people I talk to at the Walmart are not from Moundsville. They're from 100 or 200 miles away, and they drive in and get cheap apartments and live there, or they commute. But they are willing to move, and so that sort of takes away that idea that you might create like a tight labor supply and drive wages up that way.
Do you think that's purely from the necessity standpoint, or is there something sort of in the American spirit of like go west, young man kind of thing, that even if you're going west for a job that isn't super glamorous, that's sort of how we view the possibility of success in the country?
Absolutely. I think I grew up in Belgium, and I think that's a huge difference between Europeans and Americans. And my friends I went to high school with at a Belgian public high school all still live in Brussels.
Yeah,
pretty much. And even though they have found jobs, but even if they hadn't, I think they would use the safety net and I think that's a big cultural difference. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's among some folks that I know there's a little bit of a sense of like if you don't move away from home, that there's a sense of a lack of progress or personally or professionally.
Yeah.
Even if you could have a great job at home, that there's something symbolic for young Americans of saying like, all right, well, I've left, you know, not just my parents'
right.
house or the college, but like I've moved to a new city, I'm on my own, and here I am. But when you do that, you often end up in some of the big cities that have the jobs.
Maybe that's a thing that we need to talk about and needs to change.
Yeah,
right.
I think this identifying success with literally physical movement is sometimes hard on families a lot of time, and it makes it harder for young families. Often when you move away and then you settle and you have kids, but suddenly you're 500 miles from the closest family member who used to be relied upon to, you know, be the babysitter, and then you go into the childcare costs and all the, you know, it gets into the economics of things as well. When the solution to a lot of those things was you just live near people who helped you out.
I gotta say, one nice thing about living in Pittsburgh is that I have friends where I don't find out what they do for 6 months before I've known them.
I find that my husband is from Ireland, and when we go to visit him, I've been there for weeks at a time when no one has asked me anything about work. And it's very rare that would ever happen here in the U.S. with people I know.
In New York City.
Yeah, sure. Particularly in New York.
Right, right. It's one of the first things they ask about, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is also the folks that you spoke to, you know, demographically anyway, Mr. Trump carried these folks by an enormous margin, but these are folks who at one point or another may have, considered or did vote for either Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, and so you know, these are swing voters in a sense, right? And these are exactly the kind of voters that national candidates need to be talking about. So what is it that politicians need to get about these folks that they don't get now?
They're totally swing voters, and that's something I've done a lot of research on. Partly it's just personal charisma that Obama had it and Trump had it, and you capture the moment and people just like you personally. I mean, I think being or crafting a message that addresses people's concerns about work is the biggest thing. And I mean, that I think it was manipulated, but the Hillary quote about putting coal miners out of business just crushed her in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And so if politicians want to connect, I mean, I think they have to craft a message that speaks to the heart of voters' concerns about work. And there's a really interesting thing in Pittsburgh, where the United Steelworkers Union is headquartered. The USW leaders hated Trump. They really thought he was disloyal and not one of them. But the rank and file loved him because he touched their hearts with these talks about rescinding trade deals. And so if you can craft a message that, you know, speaks to that, I think you're going to win.
Yeah, and that was always Bill Clinton's point. You know, whenever the Democratic Party isn't talking about jobs, it's losing, right?
And absolutely,
because these are folks who, you know, they all supported Robert Byrd, and there is more flexibility in this polarized country of ours than you would think. By watching the news, and the national leadership of the parties, doesn't seem to get that.
I agree with you. I do worry about the information cycle, because you have a loss of sort of shared information and newspapers that everybody reads and television that everybody reads. Moundsville does have one newspaper, and it's run by this crotchety old guy who has this 120-year-old German printing press, and I walked in there. He sort of shooed me away, but he wraps up the newspaper in rubber bands and delivers them by hand after cranking them out on this 19th-century printing press. But it's gonna fade away and die in a few years, and Moundsville will have no newspaper.
Yeah.
And that's a very worrying thing. And I don't have an answer, and I wish there was some. I wish Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates would come up with a plan to fund journalism in places like Moundsville, because if everybody just watches Fox News, which is often making stuff up or has people on it that are feeding into the same kind of cyclical loop of talking points, and the same for some on the left, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and that's really where we feel the loss of newspapers is really at the local level, in places like Moundsville.
Totally.
Yeah, because our inability to share the same facts is
that's
a problem. Because, you know, if you're going to have a debate, you got to start out with some common data, and that it seems increasingly difficult to find, or at least, you know, data that we can all agree on, because we're so suspicious of the sources. It's a tough one.
I totally agree. And people like Phil, who's a Trump voter, I mean, he is very well-intentioned and would believe a case if it was made to him, I think, truthfully and honestly, and would be open to argument. I don't think all hope is lost, but I think there needs to be some evolution in public information.
Right. Right. Well, the piece is called A West Virginia Town Looks for a New Start in Trump's America. It's by John W. Miller, and it's the cover story of the most recent issue of America. John, thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for this great contribution to the magazine.
Yeah, thanks to all of you. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a remarkable story. We started out the broadcast by talking about how I was down in Florida on vacation, and I was going with my parents to the 5 p.m. early bird special at the steakhouse, choking down a steak at 5 to save $3. But there was, there was a big coupon in the local paper, and, you know, older people, they still all read local papers. And so the place was packed. I had never waited 20 minutes for a table at 5 o'clock in my life. But what was it?
Had you ever been in a table at 5 o'clock before anyway? I mean, come on.
I mean, having lunch, maybe. But what one of the things that was really interesting that, you know, I realized in talking to them and then talking to their friends is that they're very much like the folks that John talked to in this piece, in that I mean, they're a little better off, they're middle class and they're more mobile, but they also are basically voting on, you know, this who do we think is going to improve the economy and make the economy better, and they think that the rest of it is just a bunch of noise. So in this very strange way, they're really smart in figuring out that, you know, that stuff I'm hearing is just stuff, and I'm focused on this one question, and that's what they're focused on, and they're able to discern that. Yeah.
But as John also said, I mean, I think charisma does actually make a big difference.
Yeah.
Because, like, people who command attention, for good or for bad, on you know, tend to get tend to sway the electorate, you know, from Clinton to Obama to Trump.
Well, it's the who would you rather have a beer with,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's
Bush
often
too,
who people,
yeah,
vote for. The taller candidate frequently wins. Like, so you have a good chance, Matt, if you ever decide to go back into politics. Mm-hmm. But I think for our radio listeners, Matt, what are you, 6'4", 6'5"?
You're tall. 6'4".
6'4", all right.
6'4", yeah, so. And shrinking.
So your chances of being a politician are lessening with a day.
I think so, yeah. if they are still existent at all.
I think you might have ruled that one out a little while ago.
Right.
But yeah,
if
I mean,
so,
it's,
I'm running for mayor of Mansfield.
So much of politics is about emotion,
yeah,
and how someone makes you feel,
right,
and that can't be sort of what completely drives us.
No, indeed, it cannot. So you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You can find more at americamagazine.org. You can read about this story and every story that we have talked about today, and you can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And you can follow us from anywhere in the country. You can follow us from Moundsville, if you like. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Kerry Weber and Tim Reedy, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you, and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.